Hi, everyone. This is Martin Willis with the Antique Auction Podcast. And today we have a special guest, pretty excited about. He's someone who I consider has excelled to rock star status in the auction world, James Julia. Hey, Jim, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good, Bobby. I think maybe I better hire you to go out
there. Public relations?
Thank you very much for that. That's a wonderful introduction.
Yeah, well, I've watched what's happened over the years, and you and I go actually way back. My father used to buy antiques from your father many years ago, back in the 70s.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so right off the bat, I've watched your company grow and grow over the years, and have seen that you've done the right thing to make it grow. I want to talk right now about your experience recently in the map that you had go at auction. I've heard it's one of the most important American map that there in existence. Is that right?
The most important American map, but it's also a world auction record for any map ever sold at auction. It's a world record for the most expensive antique ever sold in the state of Maine at auction, and it's also a record for my firm. It brought $1,150,000, and it came from a home not too far from where you used to live.
Yeah, my old stomping grounds, Kittery Point. I saw that.
Absolutely. Would you like me to tell you a little bit about the family and the circumstances?
Yes, I really would.
Sure. Well, there's a family down on Kittery Point, and descendants of that family still own a portion of Kittery Point. At one time, they owned most of the Kittery Point in the 18th century. I think the family goes back to the late 17th century there at Kittery Point. And over the years, some of the land has been sold off. Back in the early 70s, one of the descendants of the family who still owns and owned land there wanted to purchase an old barn from the family, from the overall family. The family still owned land there, and they owned this big old barn that had a lot of things inside of it. He was a gun dealer and wanted to expand his business. In fact, for a period of time, he did expand his business and became one of the top shotgun dealers in the high-grade shotgun dealers in the world. He's no longer in business. But anyways, this barn was essentially, he wanted to buy it, fix it up, and make it into a gallery. The family all got together, and they agreed to sell it and agreed upon a price, and he agreed to buy it. However, there was a problem. The barn had numerous trunks filled with all kinds of papers and books and artifacts. And for the first time in generations, the family kind of got all of this material. They had to remove it from the barn. They got it out and spread it all out. And it was a wonderful cache of important historical material. The family had descended from a number of, had ancestral roots to a number of very important historical figures in early New England and in the early colonial period. One of which was Colonel Tobias Lear. Tobias Lear was Judge Washington's aide-de-camp, his personal best friend, and when Judge Washington passed away, Colonel Lear handled all of his papers and his library. Another member of this historical family was Commodore Stephen Decatur, the hero of the War of 1812 and also the Barbary Wars. William Pepperell, one of the first governors of Massachusetts, was connected. Judge Washington Storer, Judge Dewey. There were a number, particularly in the naval arena, there were a number of historical figures. Anyways, this family began in the early 70s. They began to sort this material out, and they called in someone that knew something about early historical documents and things and had an appraisal done at that time and then divided the things up into three piles piles of equivalent value, since there were three branches of that family that still existed. And each of the branches of the family took one segment of one-third of the things that were stored in the barn. There was one item that they couldn't divide up because it was too valuable at the time. You and I both kind of remember what it was like in the early 70s. I mean, things were just so cheap back then, but this thing was expensive even then. It was a Dunlap version of the Declaration of Independence. The Dunlap version of the Declaration of Independence was the very first time the Declaration of Independence was ever put to print. The Continental Congress wrote up the Declaration of Independence, and then they decided to set it to type and distribute it around the city, which they did at Dunlap's print shop. That was the very first time it was ever printed. They notified the residents of the city about the Declaration of Independence, and then they realized that they needed to spread this word throughout the colony, so they sent writers with copies of this printed Declaration of Independence down to Charleston, up to Portsmouth and Boston and various other major cities in the colonies. There they hired printers to once again reprint the Declaration of Independence. The very first printing, the Dunlap version from Philadelphia, today is the most valuable.
How many did they print, Jim?
I'm not sure how many they printed. Most of them were destroyed, and only a handful of them exist today. Mm-hmm. And the Dunlap version is the very most expensive version. This is what they had in that barn, a copy of the Dunlap version.
In a barn.
Which they sold for $175,000, which was a princely sum back then. However, today, if they had the same declaration, it would probably bring somewhere between $8 and $12 million.
Are you serious? Is that more value? Let's see, they hand wrote 13.
I don't think they hand wrote 13. I think they only hand wrote one, and that is in the National Archives, and it's almost illegible. You can't hardly read it because it was it was exposed to light too much. But the real problem was in the early 19th century, I think the man's name was Stone. He requested, or John Adams kind of put him up to it or agreed to allow him to do it. What he did was he took the original copy of the Declaration of Independence, and there was a process whereby you put put something on it, and you could copy exactly what
was
on it.
That's what I'm thinking of. Okay.
But in so doing, what you actually did in order to make the duplicate impression was to extract some of the actual text that was there, a portion of it. So it weakened the original version terribly, but then they put it on a stone and reprinted a whole bunch, and it was called, I'm pretty sure it's Stone's version. I think someone by the name of Stone did it. I told you the Dunlap version was the very first printing, and then they went to Boston, Portsmouth, Charleston, etc., and printed the exact same thing over and over again, but each one of those down to the bottom of the declaration indicate that they were printed in Boston or Portsmouth or something like that. In 1999, I had the Boston version that was printed at auction, and at the time, the non-Dunlap version, the record for it, was around $95,000, and I sold a copy of the non-Dunlap version for $415,000, which set a new world record for a non-Dunlap version.
Isn't that something?
Anyway, so they've divided everything up into three parts, and this was in the early 70s, and those three groups of things then went to the three different branches of the family. One branch was the Decatur Armsden branch. Mrs. Armsden, formerly at Decatur, married this gentleman who, in their later years, they retired and rented a house from one of their ancestors who still owned land there at Kittery Point, and they spent their final years there. And they retained much of what they had acquired back in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they both lived very long lives, but Mrs. Armsden passed away a few years ago, and Mr. Armsden passed away just recently. Someone contacted me and introduced me to the family, thinking that because the family was going to need to do something with this trove of goods, and they highly recommended me to the family, and the rest is history. The things, many of the most important things, were kept in a safe deposit box, but the house was filled with all kinds of things, too. And once we got everything out and sorted it, it took a long time, but who has just some terrific things. I was told before I went to the safe deposit box that there was a copy of the map of the Siege of Yorktown. And at the time, I asked if the person that was telling me about this, if they knew anything about the map, and he said, yes, he'd seen it. And I said, well, was it a working map? He said, what do you mean? And I said, well, it did have notes from Washington and or Rochambeau. Oh, yeah, he said, Washington's on there, Rochambeau's notes, right? And, you know, so I anticipated that this map was a working map produced during the siege. The history of the circumstances at that point in history was essentially this. The colonies had been waiting, literally for years. The French were kind of promising to intercede on their behalf, to lick the English. The French and English had been fighting for 100 and some odd years, just one war after the other. But although the French promised that they would intercede on our behalf, they were playing their cards right. They weren't going to join in unless they were pretty sure they were going to lick the English. And so they kind of stood back from afar and watched what was going on. And meanwhile, Washington kept hoping that they'd come, and eventually they did. At the time that they decided to join the fray, Washington had Cornwallis penned up in Yorktown. Mm-hmm. Yorktown is a town right on the water. Cornwallis wasn't the least bit worried, because if the colonials were strong enough to lay siege to the fort and possibly, destroy, break down their defenses, Cornwallis would have simply ferried his men out on the ships waiting in the harbor, and they would have sailed off to another spot. They controlled the waters. The American naval fleet was primarily privateers and that type of thing. It was not a really organized naval thing. So Cornwallis is bottled up there in Yorktown, and Washington's got him bottled up, but Washington knows that at any point in time when things get tough for him, he's just going to slip out the back door, so to speak. And about that time, the French joined the Americans. And what this meant was two things. Number one, because of their large naval armada, they could block off the harbor and thus prevent Cornwallis from retreating. Mm-hmm. And then the addition of the French troops to the colonial troops made it far easier to lay siege to the fort and thus defeat Cornwallis, and that's exactly what happened. But the French, although they were helping us, it wasn't that they loved us. They were interceding in part for their own best interest, and so they wanted to kind of position themselves so that when everything was all over, as much as possible, we would owe them. And Washington was very astute, and he was aware of this, too. So he was positioning to kind of retain control, command, and be in charge of everything. And the siege of Yorktown was quite a diplomatic thing. Rochambeau, in charge of the French troops, was trying to, so to speak, take control, spearhead everything. And Washington was trying to retain control. So they went back and forth for quite some period of time discussing, debating about how they were going to lay siege to the fort. And so when this young man told me about notes from Rochambeau in Washington, I assumed that this was a working thing actually produced during the battle, and I was extremely excited. I assumed that this might be worth literally a few million dollars. One of the most, I mean, after all, this was the most important historical military engagement ever in the history of this country. There was nothing more important, because we got as a result of this battle, we ended up with our independence once Cornwallis was defeated. Mm-hmm. So I was very, very excited about this. And then when we get to the safe deposit box, and I opened it up and I looked at the map, that was the first thing I pulled out. I was dismayed at first, because here was a period map, obviously made at the time. However, the legend on the map laid out what all the various, it was not a working map that went back and forth between Rochambeau and Washington. It was simply a map of what had happened. Hmm. It was produced after the battle, and the legend indicated the various phases of the battle and so on and so forth. So I was really dismayed. I mean, it was still wonderful. It was worth many thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. But the likelihood of it being worth a couple of million or $2 million was remote. Mm. I I then did a fair amount of research. I hired Marvin Sadik, whom I think
oh, yes.
you call.
Matt I do,
was,
yes.
Mm-hmm. He was the former director of the National Portrait Gallery.
Right.
And he's also a historical dealer now. I hired Marvin to help catalog the things, and he went away to the Osher Map Library, which I think you might also know, too. It's located in southern Maine, and it is one of the biggest American map repositories in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Marvin spent an entire day going through their collection of maps. Fortunately, he was away for a few days, and in the interim, I had spent a lot of time on the computer. When Marvin came back, he announced to me that he was afraid that my map wasn't worth very much money. And I said, really? And he said, yes. He said, there were a number of maps made of the Yorktown battle after the fact. And he said, we don't know who made this one. It's not signed. Anyways, he had lost all hope of it being very valuable. Fortunately, while he was gone, I had spent a lot of time on the Internet, and I said, well, let me tell you the rest of the story. You are absolutely right. There were many, many maps of the Yorktown siege made after the fact, but this was essentially the first one. But more importantly, I know who did it. I had discovered, and this is not common. This happens to be extraordinarily rare. There's only one other in existence, and that is in the National Archives. The one in the National Archives is larger, but it has the exact same legend written in the exact same hand and signed by Lieutenant Grevin. Lieutenant Grevin was an engineer lent to the colonies by the French. He worked directly under Washington, who had great praise for him after the war. Grevin was responsible for the production of the map. And there was a larger map in the National Archives, and that was the only other one in existence. Ours was in better condition. Theirs was larger. I later discovered, not at that time, but later on discovered, it was in many places when I saw the larger map, it was referred to as Washington's map. And about a week before the auction, I'd finally come to the conclusion that the map I had actually was General Washington's. And I did quite a bit more research on the Internet, and I discovered the one in the National Archives was part of the papers of the Continental Congress. Hmm. Now, the papers of the Continental Congress, all during the Revolutionary War, when things of significance happened, it was Washington's responsibility, just as it is today for the commander in the field, to report to the Continental Congress and present them with an overview of what's happening, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And when I discovered that the one in the National Archives was actually part of the Continental Congress papers, then I realized what this was all about. Washington obviously charged Grevin with the responsibility, right after the battle, of producing a map so that he could send it out to the Continental Congress and they could be aware of what happened, how it happened, and the lay of the land, etc. And that's exactly what's in the National Archives now. Other map, the smaller map, the map that I had, obviously was produced at the same time by Grevin's employees, whoever the cartographers that did this, and given to Washington. And the reason I say I'm certain it was given to Washington is because the only way for it to have descended down through the family was to have come through Tobias Lear. And the only reason Tobias Lear would have this is because he acquired it at the time Grevin made it. Now, Grevin would not have made a map during those days. Was like a work of art. There was a great deal of work that went into it. It wasn't something you just whipped out. And so, subsequently, that would not have been made and given to someone's secretary.
Mm-hmm.
It was given to Washington, and as I said, when Washington died, Tobias Lear handled his papers and his library. I had an inventory of his library in Lear's hand. I had many of the books that were in his library and various other papers, and so subsequently there was no question this was Washington's map. And as a result, it brought over $1 million.
That's amazing.
At the time that I cataloged it, we cataloged it, we estimated it at $5,000 to $50,000 plus, because this was before we had made all these discoveries about the Continental Congress and so on and so forth. And at the time we cataloged it, we found a map that had been drawn by Washington for the purpose of outlining a potential attack on, I believe it was Trenton, New Jersey. This was in the famous Malcolm Forbes collection when Sotheby's sold it some years back after Mr. Forbes passed on. And when I found this map, supposedly actually drawn by Washington, of a proposed battle, I was quite excited and expected that it would have brought a lot of money, but it brought less than $50,000. In fact, I think it brought less than $20,000, and I was just blown away. I couldn't believe it, and so that's how I happened to put such a low estimate on our map, and then later on came to the conclusion that it was Washington's actual map. But anyways, so the rest is history. So it was pretty exciting. There were all kinds of treasures in the same grouping. Tobias Lear was a personal friend of the family. There was a letter there in Tobias Lear's hand, and obviously he was sitting beside Martha Washington at the time, making a rough draft of the letter from Martha Washington to President John Adams. Martha's husband had just died, and essentially what the letter was doing was telling John Adams that she had reluctantly decided to agree to the request of the Continental Congress to allow her husband to be taken to Philadelphia to be buried rather than buried at home, and she was very reluctant about it because she loved him, and that's the only thing she had left in life was to the possibility of being buried with her. And that letter, written in Lear's hand, brought something like $20,000 or $25,000.
Yeah.
There was also a copy of the letter that written the next day by Tobias Lear to President Adams, essentially saying to Adams, look, John and the rest of you boys up there, you know, she has reluctantly agreed for the only vestige of any importance in her life now to go off and be interred there in Philadelphia. And you cannot do this without, at the same time, you know, agreeing to allow her, when she is passed on, to be buried beside her husband. This is the only thing she's got to live for at this point.
Hmm.
And they were both very poignant letters, and both of them brought a ton of money. But there were all kinds of wonderful historical treasures there.
You know, it's one thing I miss when I'm on the West Coast. Is I love the historical ephemera and, you know, documents and things like that. And out here you get Gold Rush era things, you know, but not every once in a while a family will migrate out this way and bring their documents and things like that. It doesn't happen too often. Now, let me ask you this. I know you have, we talked a little bit earlier, you have something of significance in San Francisco, but first of all, I wanted to ask you this. Do we know what's happened to the two-thirds of the other documents?
Yes. One-third, remember the gun dealer that I told you about?
Yes, and I know who he is, yes.
His mother inherited, one-third of the goods, and upon her demise, the things went to her two sons. And they, in turn, sold a trove of material some years back to a major historical dealer. They had Tobias Lear's journal. They had a large number of Tobias Lear's papers and some Washington papers. And they also had the original copy of the treaty between the final treaty between the Barbary Pirates. And they sold nearly everything. What happened was when I got this trove of material, I knew of some of the other members of the family that had things, and I contacted them and subsequently was fortunate enough to get some things from different members. So one of which was really interesting. There was a quarter bill for the USS Constitution. One of the, it was a watch and quarter bill. It was a big paper book, handwritten, that described, listed every naval person on board the ship, what their responsibilities were, and what their responsibilities were at time of battle, etc. There was a member of the family, George Washington Storer, who descended in the same family, and he was a lieutenant at the time on the USS Constitution, and this is why they had this. I mean, it's like, where would you ever find anything off of the oldest and most historic battleship in the U.S. Navy, the USS Constitution? This is really terrific. And that sold for just under $30,000, I think $28,000 or something.
Wow. You know, I know the gentleman you were talking about, the firearm, the shotgun dealer, and he many times has told me over the years of the rich history in his family, but I never really knew the details until now. That's amazing.
Yeah, he told me, when he went out of business, I sold a number of his things for
right.
him over a period of time. And he told me a few times that he was a descendant of Tobias Lear and told me about the connections. And I just, you and I have been in the business for a long time. We hear lots of stories, and,
mm-hmm.
and there's usually a lot of material kind of injected into the story, and you don't know whether it's true or not. And I never really paid a great deal of attention until he started producing some of these things and until I became involved with other members of the family and realized, indeed, they really were descended
yeah.
from just exactly who he said he was.
Now, he's also a descendant of John Haley Bellamy, too.
That's right, too, and he has yeah. a number of Bellamy Eagles, yes.
Right, yeah. right. So, now, we talked briefly earlier, and you said that you have something coming up that has San Francisco significance, where I'm located, so let's
yeah.
hear about that.
Yeah, of course, as you know, my company is divided up into four divisions. I have
mm-hmm.
a Finance and Antiques Division, which handled this historic trove here that we were just talking about in February. But I have a Rare Toy and Doll Division. It's one of the top three in the country. And I have a Rare Glass and Lamp Division, one of the
mm-hmm.
top divisions of this type in the world. But I also have a Firearms Division, and my Firearms Division is the leading division of its type in the world.
That's right, yeah.
And we regularly have some of the finest guns to come at auction, and this upcoming auction, which will take place March 15th and 16th, is no exception. It is an extraordinary sale, about $10 million worth of goods. And one
wow.
of the things that I have in this auction is an extraordinary, huge, solid silver service from San Francisco. It was produced, it was distributed by George C. Shree.
Oh, yes.
Who is mm-hmm. one of the big names out there.
Oh, yeah.
But the work, the silver workmanship was done by a gentleman by the name of Vanderslice.
Oh, yes.
Vanderslice came from Philadelphia and was one of the top silversmiths in the San Francisco area
mm-hmm.
during the gold rush era.
Right. Very, very much in demand.
Yes. And what I've got, this extraordinary service, I've got... the damn tray, Marty, weighs 10 pounds. It's solid silver. The tray alone, there are a couple of claret jugs, a huge wine beak ewer, a dozen goblets, a huge centerpiece bowl, and the silver tray has engraved on it four various famous vignettes from California, which include one scene depicting the giant sequoia, another scene depicting Yosemite Falls, etc.
Oh, my goodness.
This service is just absolutely a stunning service. It's in a huge walnut presentation case, and it was created and presented to the president of the Sanitary Commission. Do you know what the Sanitary Commission was?
Not actually, no.
Okay. Prior to the Civil War, if you got wounded in battle, it was your tough luck. You went home, and your wife had to take care of you, and you were on your own.
I know who you mean now. I know what you mean now.
Yep.
Yes.
During the Civil War, there was a great movement because
right.
so many
people were dying like crazy.
Men mm-hmm. were being injured and maimed in the war and came home, broken. And there was this huge movement to create what was referred to as the Sanitary Commission, and essentially
that's right.
what it was a hospitals and a means by which to take care of some of these injured, wounded veterans. And what they did was they did everything they could to make money. They would have these huge Sanitary Commission fairs in which they do everything from selling pies to, games of chance, anything they could to make money, and then they'd take all of this money to doctor soldiers or to create hospitals. And this service was presented to the president president of the U.S. Sanitary Commission, Henry W. Bellows. The entire service weighs over 30 pounds. And Bellows was the president at the time, and he was a very, very important figure in the Sanitary Commission around 1863. This was presented by his friends in San Francisco as a tribute to honor and for gratitude of his service to the sick and wounded soldiers of the National Army. The Sanitary Commission also had huge fairs. Like there was a tremendous spectacle in Philadelphia one year, and it just so happened what they would do is they would go around to the just about any manufacturer, particularly manufacturers that produced things for the war effort, like firearms companies, and they would solicit donations, like Colonel Colt. They would go to him, and sure enough, he produced some special guns so that they could give them away or raffle them off or something and make some money. And I have two special rifles that were made for the Philadelphia Sanitary Commission Fair, which will be in the same auction. By the way, Sanitary Commission eventually, I don't know if it evolved directly into, but I believe it sort of evolved into what is now the Red Cross. In fact, this entire service I was just talking about at one time was in the Red Cross Museum.
Now, that had something to do with Barton, right? I remember reading about during the Civil War when there was so many people dying from the after they were wounded from the non-sterile procedures and things like that when this commission started. And was it Sarah Barton? What am I?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
She was instrumental in that.
Yep. Yeah. You know, kind of interesting. You talk about that. During the Civil War, if you got hit by a mini ball, which would tear a big hole in you, if you got hit in any one of your appendages, your leg or your arm, they just automatically had to
amputate it off.
You guaranteed were going to get infected. And my brother-in-law, whenever I have a firearms auction, my brother-in-law and sister are right next door to me, and they have firearms auctions. They sell the less expensive things, generally the things under $5,000, and for the most part, we sell the more expensive things. Their auction takes place just before mine, and one of my clients had consigned a bunch of things to me and sent some things over to my brother-in-law and called up later and said, oh, by the way, there is a name on the backstrap of that old Colt that I gave your brother-in-law. He should point it out. So I told my brother-in-law, but also told him, get on the Internet and check this guy out. And he did, and it turns out that the guy on the backstrap, it was a Confederate, he was a doctor. He had entered the Confederacy as an assistant surgeon, but when he entered the Confederacy, just prior to it, he had been experimenting with some kind of antiseptic that involved alcohol and various herbs, and when he first entered the military, he got hit by a mini ball. And as I said, normally you just automatically had to have an amputation. You didn't screw with that. He actually went away for a little while and, with the help of a friend, treated himself with his own tincture that he had invented and survived the whole ordeal, and so went back and mass-produced this material and used it in the Confederacy, and a number of Confederate soldiers who were wounded during the war actually avoided having their limb removed because of this invention that he had.
Wow.
That meant, kind of interesting.
I meant to say Clara Barton, that's who it is. But now, when you're talking about the Vanderslice Shreve, I know I handled a presentation urn. It was pretty interesting, but not anywhere near as special as that. And it still went for either $15,000 or $18,000. So, have you come up with an estimate yet on this?
This is, I can consider this very reasonable. It's estimated at $20,000 to $35,000, and this is a huge 10-pound sterling engraved tray with these vignettes, huge centerpiece bowl,
wow,
two claret jugs, huge wine ewer, and a dozen elaborate goblets, all within their presentation case. I mean, I just think this, you know, here I am on the extreme other end of the world. Obviously, you were just talking about history and how it's so difficult to find early American history on the West Coast. But, you know, in place of colonial history, what you have is that history that surrounds the era of the gold rush and shortly thereafter. And this is something like, this is to die for, so to speak.
Sure.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
It's really terrific.
You're going to have some very interested parties out here bidding on that. Now,
Let me tell you about one other thing.
Sure.
That would be of interest of your folks out there. everyone thinks that the Pony Express was the very first form of fast mail in the West.
Mm-hmm.
And in actuality, it wasn't. It was predated by a company known as the Jackass Mail. And what it was a stage line that ran from San Antonio, Texas to San Diego. And it was the first fast mail in the West.
Hmm.
And the man who owned it, his name was James Birch. Actually, it came from the same collection as this other gun that I just mentioned, the Confederate gun. This particular, it's a small Colt Root in its original case. And it wasn't in terrific condition. And normally isn't something that would bring a great deal of money. But on the back strap was presented to James E. Birch from the inventor, Samuel Colt. Samuel Colt himself, on occasion, presented firearms to certain key figures. And the only reason he gave away firearms was because the person was of importance and could result in a great number of potential gun sales later on. And when I saw this, that it was from Samuel Colt, if it had been from Bob Martin or something like that, you'd have just been curious. But knowing that it came from Samuel Colt, the inventor, I knew that this guy had to be important, and I started doing some research, and sure enough, he was the owner of, as I said, the first fast mail in the West. It was before the Pony Express, and it was referred to as the Jackass Stage. And this gun is really pretty neat. I think we've got it estimated at $10,000 to $20,000 or $15,000 to $20,000, and it's a truly important historical thing associated with the gold rush days.
Wow. Now, Jackass Stage doesn't sound like very fast mail to me, but I know what you're saying. Yeah. Hey, I was thinking this seems like the perfect time to sell something great, because what I'm seeing, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that, but what I'm seeing is I think there's a lot of people a little fearful of what's going to happen with the dollar, and they're getting their dollar into really high-end items. What do you think about that?
In the past, you know, I've been in the business for 40 years, and it used to be that with the exception of firearms, as our economy went up, you know, the marketability of collectibles went up, and as the economy dropped off, the marketability dropped off. It didn't drop off to the same dramatic level that the economy did,
mm-hmm.
but it would soften up.
Mm-hmm.
You could still sell collectibles, even though the stock market was, it flattened out, and even though a lot of people had lost their job, but people weren't so desperate to buy when the economy was bad. In 19 and around 2000, when we had that dot-com craze,
mm-hmm.
and everything imploded, and it was one of the most disastrous falls. You know, when the dot-coms imploded, the stock market dropped. I can't remember what it was. It was some dramatic amount, and a great number of people in that previous year and a half had become extraordinarily wealthy, and in a 24-48 hour period of time, you know, it was almost, it wasn't the same as the Depression, but it was traumatic. There was such an extraordinary amount of money lost in a very short period of time.
Hmm.
When that happened, as normally happens, I fully expected that the marketability of collectibles would drop off fairly significant, and then we would start working our way back over the coming years. Well, the next auction I had, about a month and a half later, I did absolutely very well, and I thought, gee, boy, am I good. But I had another auction, and I did extremely well, and I said, I am really good. And then I started looking around at my competitors, and I noticed they were doing very well, but that wasn't what had happened for the previous 30 years, and it took me a little while to realize what happened. What happened in this particular situation here was that so many people got hurt so bad in the stock market in such a short period of time, they were looking, and so many people had withdrawn their money from the market, and it was just sitting there. Mm-hmm. You know, trillions of dollars, so to speak, sitting on the sideline. Well, there were some people at that time, around the year 2001, that looked around and they said, gee, I really like historical items, or I really like paintings, or I really like Winchester rifles. I think I'll buy some tangible assets. They didn't change their collecting, they didn't change their investment focus entirely to collectibles, but there were some people that entered the collectibles market and they had lots of money. And this wasn't going to replace their investment portfolio, but it now became part of a diversified investment portfolio. Now, some of these people were buying Winchester rifles. Some of them were buying paintings. Some of them were buying land in Florida. Mm-hmm. But there was more focus on tangible assets. And, of course, as we know, gradually they re-entered the marketplace, but they continued now to buy Winchester rifles or historical documents or something like that. And so what happened in 1999 and the year 2000, when things first created this huge bubble and everything was wonderful, and then the bubble popped, normally you expect everything to soften up, and it didn't. It just got firmer with each year. And for a period of almost 10 years, we experienced in the antique trade something that I've never experienced in my lifetime, and that was just overall a period of continual appreciation. Things just got better year after year, and that was not the way it had ever worked before. And with this most recent adjustment in the marketplace, there was no question that there was a realignment. Get it softened up. Things were tougher to sell. Mm-hmm. When you go to antique shows, and there are lots of people there, but there are lots of tire kickers. It's tough to get them to pull the trigger, so to speak. You've got three categories of people. The one person doesn't have any money anymore to buy. Mm-hmm. Another category has some money. They're not extraordinarily wealthy, but they have some money, and they're going to be very cautious about how they spend it, even though they can afford that $10,000 painting. They may be worth a matter of multiple millions of dollars, but not $800 million. And so they might buy a $10,000 painting or a document or a gun, but they're going to be more careful in this new environment. And some of them were holding back and trying to just focus on bargains shortly after. And then you've got the third category, and that's the very, very wealthy, the very affluent. Well, One category can't buy anything if they want to. The other category can, but they have to be careful. And the third category can still afford to buy whatever they want. The ones that had money for the last year have sort of kind of, a certain portion of them have kind of held back a little bit, hoping to take advantage of the circumstances. And, you know, this is now a buyer's market as opposed to 10 years of seller's market. But one thing that people, I think, are beginning to realize is that while everything was adjusted downward after October 2008, mm-hmm. for the most part, good collectibles, whether it's Tiffany lamps, great historical documents, rare Winchester rifles, Colt revolvers, while they also softened up, they did not soften up to the extent that the stock market did. They didn't soften up to the extent that land in Florida did. They didn't soften up to the extent that they softened up, but they didn't soften up as much as the other things. There's a very good reason for that too. So this is a long-winded response to your very simple question, but what I noticed for the previous 10 years, this thing just got better and better and better, and I kept preaching every year to my people and people that I worked with, this was not reality, it would not keep on going forever like this, there was going to be an adjustment, and sure enough, an adjustment has come, but I think what you're going to find is that not only did our marketplace not adjust as much as some of these other not only did it not soften up as much as some of these other marketplaces did, but I think that you're going to find that it's going to re-strengthen in a reasonable period of time. I do not mean that prices and demand will return to the giddy heights of 2007. We lived in a seller's market for about 10 years. Mm. And when I talked to people, I explained the difference. I said, look, 2007, here's what it was like. You were standing there looking at buying a great Tiffany lamp, and you looked over your shoulder, and there was this great big huge crowd, kind of like the Verizon ad. And that crowd represented the other buyers who wanted what you were thinking about buying. There was this tremendous pressure. It was a seller's market. If you don't buy it, somebody else is going to buy it. So you bet to buy it. And that was kind of the attitude. And there were lots of people with fat pockets filled with cash, etc. Today, you get ready to buy something, you look over your shoulder, that huge crowd is no longer there. There are three or four people standing back there. Mm. That's your competition. It's changed considerably. Now, it will begin to swing back the way up to where it was before, but I don't expect that we're going to see something, as I said, something giddy like 2006, 2007 in the next year. But I do think that you'll find things gradually firming up. I mean, you go to auctions, you're involved in the auction process. You had auctions all through last year. You may have not done as well with the things that you sold last year as you did 2 years ago, but people still came in, they still bought, and some of the things they paid a lot of money for.
Sure.
And we've got an advantage over the stock market. We've got an advantage over investment land. And that advantage is the passion of the collector.
Mm.
The reason that
Good
people
point.
Buy Tiffany lamps or Winchester rifles or George Washington documents is because they're passionate about what they collect.
That's
they
right.
don't have to have any of those things. It's like a diamond necklace. You don't have to have it. Mm. It's a luxury. But fortunately, those people that collect with passion. And even when things are bad, they still need to fulfill they need a fix.
That's
they
right.
To continue. And that's good for us. It's good from a standpoint of staying power because it holds value. So goods continue to be worth money. I mean, you know, why should someone pay $1 million for a piece of paper, a hand-drawn map?
Mm.
I mean, that's a phenomenal amount of money, particularly right now. But it's because of passion, because of,
right.
you know, the love of history and the significance. It's the silver service we were just talking about. I mean, it's silver service. You know, we've got it only estimated for $20,000 to $35,000, and it might sell for $20,000. But that's such an extraordinary set that if it brought $45,000 or $55,000, it wouldn't be a surprise.
Sure.
And what would drive a person to buy it? Passion, their love for old things, their sense of love for history, etc.
Right. Right. We had a gentleman that owned Argentum Silver out here that passed away a year and a half ago, and he would have loved to have seen that silver service you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to your map, I'm going to ask you, first of all, we're kind of running out of time here, but I wanted to ask you what it was like to sell it. And also, I heard a rumor that you were speechless after you sold it. Is that true?
you know that's not true. let's see. Basically, I sold a lot of expensive things in my life, but I've never broken $1 million barrier. I came close in 2008 when the stock market crashed. The next day, I had a gun auction of all things. Mm. I was sweating bricks.
Oh, I bet.
Because the stock market had dropped like 10%, and all the news on the media the night before implied that the world banking auto was on the verge of collapse, and and I had this huge, important gun auction the next 2 days.
Oh, boy.
The gun auction still did 11, you know, I was talking about the sustainability driven by passion. I did $11.5 million
in
that auction, despite the drastic things that were happening just before. And I sold a Colt Walker pistol for for the world record of the most expensive firearm ever sold at auction in history, anywhere in the world. And that was just under $1 million. So I was kind of bummed because I really thought that gun would bring a million or more. And so when this map came up, as I said, my anticipations of the map were like the tide in the Bay of Fundy. You know, first it was way up here, and then it was way down, and then it was way up again. And by the time the auction had come around, I had reaffirmed, my enthusiasm for this map. It just, you know, now I was convinced by the time that I got ready to sell it that this map had belonged to Washington. I was aware of its significance, its rarity, and I really thought that would bring a few hundred thousand dollars, not the $50,000 we'd estimated it for. And when it got up to around $500,000, I thought, wow, this is great. And then it got up to $600,000 or $700,000, and I said, oh my gosh. And then it got up to $850,000, and I'm saying, yes! Now with the buyer's premium, I was doing this in my head while I was auctioning. I get it. You know, I'm at $1 million now. And the guy in the audience bid $850,000. The guy on the phone had been jumping the bid, attempting to try and drive him off.
Sure.
And I think it was around $850,000. The phone bidder hollered out $1 million.
Wow.
And it jumped from $850,000 to $1 million in it. And it was, yes!
Unbelievable.
No, that was pretty exciting. And it was...
Can't imagine.
You know, and the thing, what enhanced the excitement was not only was it $1 million, but it was for something that I, and because of the circumstances, I and literally almost anyone who participated or observed that never anticipated to bring anywhere near that. With the gun that I'd sold the year before, I knew there was a possibility it could break $1 million, and it didn't. With this piece here, by the time the auction came around, like I said, I'd regained my confidence in it, and I really hoped, thought, and anticipated it might bring a few hundred thousand dollars. We had 25 people on the phone and a number of people in the audience for the lot, so by then I was pretty convinced that I was right about my anticipations that it was very good. But I never expected that it would bring nearly $1 million, let alone over $1 million.
So wow.
It was a terrific surprise, a terrific, mile point in my business. And,
sure.
And that was, it was exciting.
Now, can we talk about who bought the map?
He's a private individual.
Wow, that's amazing.
And he bought it for his own personal collection. He collects Washington-related objects. I also had a letter in this same auction written to Judge Washington's nephew, George Augustine Washington. In the letter, it was a four-page letter, and Judge Sr. was writing to his nephew and giving him marital advice. The nephew had just gotten married. Mm-hmm. And Washington also advised the nephew that he and Martha were planning on leaving the nephew a portion of their estate when they were gone. Unfortunately, the young man died before Washington did. But it was a terrific letter. It brought, about $130,000.
That's amazing.
That letter also. Sometimes buyers would happy to let you divulge that they bought it, but he wanted to stay anonymous, so we've had to
sure
request.
Absolutely. Jim, we're going to have to wrap it up, but I want you to be able to tell people how they can find you on the internet. First of all, what's your website address?
The website address is jamesdjuliauctioneers.com.
Okay.
And
your phone number is right here in front of me.
207-453-7125. So they can call, or they can just access their internet and just type in James Jr. and it'll take them to our. But the official address is James D as in decoy website. Our website has is a great historical repository of information about past auctions and prices realized, so
right.
It's a great rate research site. And also, we always keep it updated with what's coming up, including our entire catalogs online. So, yep,
right.
Everything's right there. And it'll introduce them to us, and if they're coming to Maine, it'll let them know what we've got coming up, and if they have things to sell that they think would do better on the West Coast for some reason, there's all kinds of details on the line that will help them there, too.
Yep, I've recommended a number of people over since I've been in California when they have a very interesting firearm to send it back to. I don't know if that's ever come through or not, but if you're listening to this and you have something really rare in firearms and lamps and things like that, even though you might think of Maine as being a small little state, this is the biggest firearms dealer in the world, auctioneer in the world, right here we're talking to today, James Julia. And thank you so much, Jim. And we're going to wrap it up, and I'll be talking to you real soon.
Yeah, great, Matty. Just to expand upon what you just said, our firm is located in Maine, but we are the second, by dollar volume, we are the second largest auction house east of New York City. In fact, we're one of the top, by auction sales, we're one of the top auction companies in all of North America. And one last thing, I just want to wish you well with your new auction business.
Well, thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you. All right, Jim. You take care, huh?
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Nice
talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye. That was the great Jim Julia up in Maine. And this is Martin Willis in the Antique Auction Podcast. And Phyllis will be with me in the next interview. Thanks for listening today. And this is Martin Willis signing off.